Starting hour number two, live from the Quicken Loan Studios in Southern California, I'm Jim Rome. Apply simply, understand fully, and mortgage confidently. Starting the second hour, coming off the interview with David Forst. Got an email from the finest punk rock guitarist ever, Greg Hetson. Greg Hetson emails, Jim, I'm currently at the 405 and 101 interchange. Kill me now. Great interview as usual. You're the man. Talk to you later. My man, sorry about that, G. Sorry about that. I grew up in the Valley. I lived in the Valley for much of my life. I am well aware of that 405-101 interchange. There is nothing like that. I no longer live there. I don't miss that at all. I don't envy you. I don't miss that. That is a tough, tough interchange. I'm going to argue that's the toughest interchange in the country, 405-101. I might get some pushback. But then again, I might not because that is nasty. Something else I'm not going to listen to. Don't at me with a better punk rock guitarist than Greg Hetson, because there isn't one. Fact. It's not a take. That's not an opinion. Fact. Stucknut's in. Stucknut tweets, I think Take Time to Release Welcome to the Jungle on vinyl so Adam Hawk and the other youngsters can listen. Vinyl is back in a big way with the hipsters. No denying that, Steve-O. Welcome to the Jungle is not GNR Welcome to the Jungle. He was referencing my Jungle CD back in the day. Welcome to the Jungle. It is true. I have a record. I have a CD. My man, Andy Gershon. You remember Andy Gershon? He came in here once and took a run at Phish. Andy Gershon and Scott Litt were the masterminds behind that record. And Brian Albers, who tried to produce the record over Scott Litt, although Scott Litt produced, among other things, REM, The Replacements, Green Day. He's like a brilliant record producer. And Whitey's like, nah, I got this, Scotty. Step on over. All right, more on that in a minute. Love that story. As promised, we're joined right now by a senior NFL reporter for Yahoo. We've got lots to cover with him, Charles Robinson. Charles, good to have you back. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, brother. How are you doing today?
Good, good, man. Great to talk to you. Thanks so much. Let's go back to yesterday morning. What was your initial reaction when you saw the Instagram post alleging that LeSean McCoy had some level of involvement in a home invasion where his estranged girlfriend was assaulted?
I mean, just shock. You know, it was the brutality of the photo, you know, it was pretty unbelievable. And you know, knowing that this was someone that was living in a home owned by LeSean McCoy, pretty, you know, 6,000 square foot, beautiful home north of Atlanta, you know, instantaneously, you know, this is going to be a pretty problematic situation for LeSean McCoy, particularly knowing that there was a protracted legal battle between the two parties, that LeSean McCoy had been trying to get this ex-girlfriend out of his house for a while now. And, you know, for something like this to happen at 3 a.m, obviously we learned more details as the day went on. Pretty stunning. And I think it was also one of those moments where over the years, you've heard all these complaints about why the NFL has its own team involved in investigating domestic violence. Well, you know, that photo showed us why. I mean, because of the furor that is created when something like that pops up, the NFL just does not have the luxury of sitting by and letting authorities sort it out before getting their own feet on the ground.
All right, so that's a really key point, which I want to go back to in 1 minute. But the photo goes viral, and as you wrote, quote, in the space of a few hours, the NFL had a star player confronted with brutal accusations without having any idea whether McCoy was involved or not, end quote. So purely from a reporter standpoint, how do you go about dealing with a story like that?
Well, I mean, it was bananas. You had a number of outlets, you know, that were carrying the accusation, you know, on Twitter and Facebook and every other social media platform. There's already sort of a solidification amongst some readers of guilt or innocence. And the reality was, we didn't even know what the details were. I called the Milton Police Department, and to my surprise, a few hours into this, there hadn't even been a fully fleshed out police report created to be released. And, you know, so in that situation, I think you just have to approach it from a factual standpoint. Look, yes, this is his house. Yes, this is his ex-girlfriend. But the next question is, number one, where's LeSean McCoy right now? Where was he when this supposedly happened? Number two, what are the details of the incident? And and then you move on from there. And I think that's sort of what happened yesterday as details came out. We came to find out that, you know, LeSean McCoy provably was in another state. He was in the state of Florida. You know, had evidence to back that up. You know, provably this was another individual that was in the home and committed this assault and robbery. But then we also learned things like there was no forced entry. You know, this was a house that was locked and had a security system that had been replaced by LeSean McCoy recently, and yet someone was able to gain entry to that house, according to the attorney of the victim, without forced entry. But it's so early now. We're still waiting on, you know, some of the details of the investigation from both the police department. And then on top of that, you have basically everybody's lawyering up. LeSean McCoy has hired a high-profile defense attorney in Atlanta by the name of Don Samuel, who's pretty well-respected in Atlanta legal circles. The alleged victim has her own attorney, and I think we're going to start that sort of public relations battle that begins on top of concurrent investigations, both by the NFL Domestic Violence Unit and then also the Atlanta Police Department.
Charles Robinson, Yahoo Sports senior NFL reporter, excuse me. Let me go back to your other point, too. You know, as you write, a few years back, an agent was very irritated because his player was being visited by legal investigators regarding an allegation made by a former girlfriend and raised the question, why is the league investigating something that the local police can or should be investigating? So how would you answer that question?
Well, you know, I would say up front, you've heard that frustration for a number of years, whether it's from teams or players or, you know, the agents of players or lawyers or whoever, essentially saying, look, this process is so opaque. I have, someone showing up from Lisa Friel, who's the lead investigator for domestic violence cases for the league, essentially dispatches an investigator out to wherever an NFL team is or wherever a player might live to ask questions saying, hey, look, there's this allegation that's been sort of levied against you. I need to ask you some questions about this. And then the complaint that you usually hear is, we don't know what's going on. What does this mean? Is there an investigation? Is this open? Is it closed? How long is this going to drag on? Do we need to, you know, mount a defense right now? You know, so I get that complaint. But as I wrote, look, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, when the Ray Rice incident happened and then the tape came out, the world changed for the NFL. It realized we can't sit by and let someone else handle this process and then dictate what our sort of outcome is going to be on this end based on legal matters. Sometimes we feel like legal matters don't meet the standard that we want. And, you know, at least partially from a PR standpoint, we need to have our own in-house investigative unit to get that. I think on Tuesday you saw why, because a picture went out there and it was everywhere. Within a couple of hours, it was, you know, coast to coast, every website. It was the biggest story in the NFL, and it was stunning, and we didn't even know whether there was provable guilt or innocence or really even what some of the details were. So the NFL in a situation like that, we know now why they can't wait, because of what happened on Tuesday. They have to have an instantaneous movement behind closed doors to start their own process. They can't just sit there and let things sort of sort themselves out.
Charles Robinson joining us. You know, it was amazing to watch that thing when it hit Twitter, to see that thing just kind of snowball and move faster and faster and faster. So how much has social media changed how the league has to respond?
I think it's, you know, pretty significant, particularly in the case, you know, in situations like this where, you know, domestic violence is rightfully a very hot button issue, you know, for the league. And I think that, you know, social media, it in a way solidifies an opinion in one direction or another within, you know, if not hours, minutes, you know, for the NFL. And the NFL is constantly, it's always been so PR forward, but I think more in the last 4 years, whether it's been, you know, what's going on with the national anthem, that being a constant thing, Donald Trump being a constant thing, you know, domestic violence, CTE, these are all issues that play out in real time, you know, and harden opinions, solidify opinions very quickly in social media. I think Donald Trump alone has shown how the NFL has had difficulty sort of dealing with a social media platform. You have someone so powerful who instantaneously can reach out and strike at your league consistently and over again. And the NFL has had a very hard time figuring out how to deal with that, other than now just deciding to ignore the president of the United States. So there's no doubt that it has shaped how the NFL has to defend itself from a public relations standpoint. And I think, you know, you're going to see it's already started. Millions and millions of dollars have been poured into this effort, and that's only going to get bigger as we move forward.
Got a couple of minutes still with Charles Robinson joining us on the show. So what's your sense as to how team owners feel about the way the league handles situations like this? In other words, does it take pressure off of the individual teams, or do they not like the fact that they may lose one of their players for a number of games?
I think it cuts both ways. I think some teams like – so, for example, right now the Buffalo Bills have the luxury of saying, look, the NFL has its own unit doing this investigation. We're corresponding with them, but really, you know, we're letting them take the lead. That's how this works. Now, we do have our own team security, but it's not on our team security to really be the lead in this investigation. Instead, we're looking to the league for guidance. That's what we pay this millions of dollars for this investigative unit. And, you know, we're expecting you before training camp to give us some idea exactly what direction this is headed in. But then it can also cut the opposite ways. You know, you have an Ezekiel Elliott case where the Dallas Cowboys felt like lost. They never knew what exactly was going on. Jerry Jones was, you know, I think at times incensed that he was not given more continual updates or what he thought were accurate updates regarding Ezekiel Elliott. So, yeah, you know, I think it's something that really cuts both ways. But I also, what I think is really interesting, what I think a lot of people are missing out now is I think we're starting to see with some of these investigations, the NFL, there's been some pressure from owners to not get into protracted legal battles as they did with Ezekiel Elliott or Tom Brady, start to settle these cases out, offer players the ability, hey, we did the investigation. Instead of getting six games or whatever we may suspend you, don't fight us on it. Take the settlement now. Look at Jameis Winston. There's for every, you know, look, Jameis Winston, there should have been a six-game suspension standard. He got three, and I think part of that was the NFL going, here's our evidence. We'll fight you on this. If you want to fight us in court, we'll do that. Or you can settle now, take the three games, and we don't have to go through that projected legal battle, which saves the NFL money but still accomplishes its purposes of having maybe that higher standard that isn't there otherwise.
Got it. Before I let you go, I got to ask you, you tweeted about this. You had a LASIK exam. One of my favorite things ever. I got to ask you, how did that go for you and how are you feeling about the whole process?
It went well so far. I mean, we'll see. I guess I'll have fewer excuses for all the mistakes that I make either watching games or writing about them. So we'll see.
Dude, I got to tell
so
you, man,
far,
don't,
so
let me tell you something.
Hookup, let me know.
Let me tell you something. I did this more than 10 years ago, literally the best thing ever. I had like a laser fetish after that. I would do it again. I'd pay for it again the morning after when you take those things off. It is the greatest thing ever. I'm telling you, I would do this thing once a year if I could. You have nothing to worry about. It is awesome. You got to
okay.
do it.
Well, you just got to promise me the next segment we do next time, it will be all laser fetish questions.
Oh, yeah. I'll do it the day after. I'll do it the day after you do that thing. You got it, Charles. Great to have you on, man. Thanks so much. Charles Robinson, senior NFL reporter for Yahoo. He is really, really good at what he does. I mean that sincerely. That LASIK procedure, when I did that, and I did that more than a decade ago, imagine you can never see anything past your nose, and then you get cut. You don't even get cut. You get lasered. And then you wake up the next morning, and you see everything that you haven't seen for years, and it's not cheap. And it's a little bit different. I mean, you don't usually get a laser to the eye. I would do that thing once a year and pay for it once a year if I could get that same feeling once a year. It was absolutely incredible. But then let me fast forward ahead for you. It's been about 10 years, and the guy who did mine did an amazing job, and I'm really happy with it. But understand, it does not last forever. So you go out about 10 years, and now I'm back to kind of where I started. Like, I can still see at a distance, but I can't read things up close. So now what's the adjustment? I was hoping I went back in, they'd say, oh, no problem, Rome. We'll laser you again. Good, because I have a laser fetish. Like, who knows what goes on behind closed doors? Who knows what people are into? I'll be very upfront about this. I'm transparent. I've got a fetish. It's a laser fetish. I want to do it again. So now that I can no longer see up close, I'm hoping they say, come back in, we'll run that thing back on you. That's not what they do. They can't run it back on you. So now I've got options. And here's my option. Here's my new laser fetish. Here's the new thing that I got. Disposable contact lenses, and I wear one. One a day. I have one contact lens in my eye, not the other eye. So the one eye can see at a distance. The one contact lens adjusts for me to read, and that's how I deal with it. So I said to the optometrist, like, that's kind of whack. It's kind of weird. Will my eyes adjust? She said, yes, that's they whack. Will. They kind of have. Kind of, sort of. Not as good as the day after, man. Not as good as getting lasered. Nothing was. And before I did that, somebody said to me, I did it. It made me feel 10 years younger. I mean, it's all those things. I am a huge, huge proponent of that. I get nothing out of it other than getting to relive how awesome that was. I looked out my window the morning after. I'm like, holy bleep. I don't do drugs. I don't know what that's like, hallucinogens. It must be like that. Imagine seeing everything in 3D that you hadn't seen for years. Not nearly as cool as back in the day when I used to rock those hard lenses and they would dry out and they'd get lost in my head. And then I'd be like, did I get that thing out or not? That was a pretty gruesome time. I'd have those things get, like, they get dried out and they get stuck upside your head and they'd be there for days. I mean, really crazy, crazy stuff like that. Sticking hard plastic in your eye, because that was cool. Short time out. Charles Robinson, man, get it. Got nothing to be worried about. It's awesome. Now, do you know where I go for energy products? I mean, would you not agree that I've got good energy every single day on the program? Here's where I go for my energy products, my sports nutrition, and my vitamins, GNC. GNC. Because with GNC Auto Deliver and Save, you do not have to worry about missing a daily dose of your favorite vitamins or supplements. Because once you set up your free subscription, GNC takes care of the rest, shipping your products automatically, free of charge, and with 10% off that order. Not to mention, you will never pay a membership fee, and you can change your order at any time. Quality shipped, wellness delivered. Visit GNC.com or go to a store near you to learn even more. GNC.com or walk into a store nearby.
You're listening to The Jim Rome Show.
This weekend, the PGA Tour heads to TPC Deer Run in the Quad Cities community of Silvis, Illinois. Bryson DeChambeau defends his title, and with a win, he could become the FedEx Cup points leader. The John Deere Classic this weekend on CBS. Joel Sherman coming up in about 15 minutes. My thanks to Charles Robinson. I want to talk about the Canadians and the smack off. That's coming up too. In the meantime, quick reminder. My name is Jim Rome, and Alex Bregman is going to walk you off. These are facts. Neither one is more true than the other because neither one can be debated. There is no other side. There is no other argument here. My birth certificate and driver's license say James Philip Rome. And if Alex Bregman is batting in the bottom of the ninth or the bottom of an extra inning, he's going to walk you the hell off. And last night in H-Town, and we talked about this already, Bregman officially retired the old Ben Franklin line about death and taxes being the only certainty in the world, because death and taxes have nothing on this kid from the ABQ, tied 5-5 in the bottom of the 11th. Bregman goes to the dish for what can only be described at this point as a formality, because once again, it's Alex Bregman in a walk-off situation, and those only end in one way. It's just this time, it ended in the most bizarre way possible. With runners on first and second, and only one out, A's all-star closer, Blake Treinen, made the biggest mistake of his career and decided to pitch to Bregman. I mean, don't get me wrong. Pretty much every skipper's handbook in the history of the game dictates you pitch to that hitter in that exact situation, unless that hitter is Bregman. Bregman is a lock to walk you the hell off, and he did again.
Tapper near the plate, and Everybody's in play. They both advance. The throw's away. The Astros are going to win it. The Astros are going to win. Unbelievable. A ball that went about 5 feet in front of home plate. Alex Bregman has two of those this year. That one was shorter than the one previous. That ball somehow stayed fair. How did Alex avoid the tag? The ball was thrown away to end the game.
Stays on the line, goes fair. Lucroy is going to tag him. It comes out of his hand?
Yes, and then hits the umpire.
And then just bedlam ensues.
AT&T Sportsnet with that. I mean, on the one hand, I got to say, it's an amazing thing to see. It's an amazing play. I just wish that it happened against somebody other than my man David Forrest and the A's. Anybody but the A's and David Forrest. Anybody but them. But that was an amazing play. It's a choked up, defensive, swinging bunt that traveled maybe 5 feet in front of the plate. A ball that spun foul, allegedly, up the first baseline with so much English that it kind of spun back the other way into fair play. A's catcher Jonathan Lucroy picked it up, went to tag Bregman, missed, dropped the ball, clanked it off the umpire, scooped it up a second time, fired down to first, missed, hit Bregman in the back of the helmet, which allowed Kyle Tucker to score all the way from second base with the winning run. In other words, text freaking book. Astros win, drive home safely, thanks for coming. And if you think that was weird, and it was weird as hell, consider that Bregman walked off the Padres earlier this season with this glorious 20-foot infield pop-up.
And Bregman pops it up on the infield. Four infielders converging. Who wants it? Hosmer! It drops behind him! Fisher scores!
Hosmer kept looking for help, and by the time the ball dropped, the Astros won on a 20-foot pop-up that lands in fair territory.
I don't even know what to say. I cannot believe that that just happened.
Except that it just happened again, and even more impressively. This guy is like a freaking wizard. He's like a witch. It's like witchcraft. That was 3 months ago, and then last night, he notched his major league leading fifth walk-off of the season. He's got more walk-offs than Cole Hamels, Noah Syndergaard, and Clayton Kershaw have wins. And the walk-off last night was so freaky that it's burying the fact that he also jumped ship twice in yesterday's game. I mean, this dude is on another level. Another level. His mug is looking clean since taking down that stash mid-game, and he is straight raking. And he's a lock to get mobbed by his squad if he's at the dish with all the chips in the middle. And if you're John Lucroy, no sense in kicking yourself for kicking that ball. The second that rock rolled back fair, it was over. It doesn't matter that play gets made a million times out of a million times. It's never getting made when Bregman is in the middle of it in a walk-off situation. Because this is the newest saber metric in baseball. Walk Alex Bregman or he's going to walk you the hell off. He's done it 5 times. This year. Still ahead. The Canadians trying to walk away with the smack off. Eddie George standing next to a portrait that allegedly does not look anything like Eddie George. At least not Eddie George today. Maybe Eddie George in about 40 years. But again, all of you rushing in to kill the artist involved with that, I think are out of line. Off base, out of line. All of this still ahead, but we talk some more baseball with Joel Sherman, a New York Post MLB reporter, which is coming up next. But before I get to any of these things, I do owe you a...
Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show on CBS Sports Radio.
Barbasol razors. After 100 years of making shaving cream, Barbasol is finally making razors. That's a no-brainer, right? Try the new Barbasol Ultra 6 Plus with 6 ultra-thin blades. Save right now at Barbasol.com. Barbasol.com. We are efforting Joel Sherman, a baseball columnist. Lots to talk to him about. I don't think that's pretty funny with my contact lens stories, right? Believe me, there's nothing funny about hard lenses, man. They were brutal. Brutal. I'm dating myself. I go way back. Is there anybody listening who used to wear those things? Man, they were so nasty. Again, imagine sticking hard plastic in your eye, and then imagine those things drying out and then slipping along your eye. They would go upside under my eyelid and get stuck, and I would lose them. And then I'd be trying to kind of like force it out of my eye, but I didn't know whether or not it was there because I couldn't find it. Not a good time, which is why I was pretty pumped when soft lenses came out. But not as pumped as taking the laser to the eye, which was awesome. We are joined right now by a baseball columnist for the New York Post. He is also an MLB Network insider. A ton to talk to Joel Sherman about. Joel, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. Thanks for having me on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Josh. Joel, I should say. I was just talking about another Josh. Great to have you on. Joel, let me ask you this. There was a lot of buzz about the Yankees potentially making a move for Manny Machado. Then he goes 3-for-4 last night with a couple of home runs against New York. You spoke with Brian Cashman yesterday. He was not that interested in talking about Machado. How would you describe his mood overall, and how is he going to approach the next few weeks before the deadline?
Yeah, so I would think of it a little bit like Brian Cashman needs a couch, has shown up in a furniture store, and there's no couches available.
Right.
What they need most is a high-end starting pitcher. They have one of the best starters in the sport, Luis Severino, and their rotation is a little Gladys Knight in the Pips. He's Gladys Knight, and then there's a bunch of Pips who are not really trustworthy. And as they're trying to track down the Red Sox for the rest of this season and think about playoff series, they'd like someone else to be in there. The only real potential guys you can imagine being in the trade market in the next 3 weeks are Jake DeGrom and Noah Syndergaard from the Mets. A, I don't believe, Jim, that the Mets are hankering certainly to trade DeGrom, and I don't know that there's enough time. Syndergaard hasn't even made it a start yet off of the DL to do it. And then I think if the Mets were ranking 1 to 29, the teams they were most likely to make a trade with, the Yankees would be 29 with a downward-facing bullet. They just don't want to help the team on the other side of the Triborough Bridge. So when it comes to a high-end starting pitcher, that is might not be in this marketplace. And so the question becomes, if you can't stop teams from scoring, do you try to then score more by getting Machado? Or do you try to take what's already, I think you can make a pretty strong argument, the best bullpen in the major leagues with the Yankees, and making it even stronger to shorten the amount of work needed by the non-Severino part of the rotation? And I think that's what the exercise the Yankees are essentially going through, Jim, now for the next 3 weeks, is they know they've got a real battle here to avoid a one-game playoff, to try to beat out the Red Sox to at least get into a division series. But they also know they have a team that's probably good enough to win a couple of series and maybe even a championship in October. And so they want to do everything possible to maximize that without too badly damaging their near future. And I think that's all the balls that Brian Cashman is juggling, trying to figure out what to do here now over the next 3 weeks.
Joel Sherman joining us. All right, so a lot to unpack there, Joel. As you pointed out also, if we go back to the offseason, the Yankees inquired about Giancarlo Stanton, but it was not a real need at that time. Then they made the move because the Stanton market collapsed and they were able to get a good deal. Could you see a deal for Machado following a similar path, or is there just too much interest in him?
Yeah, so I think there will be some similarities, Jim. I mean, Brian Cashman, his greatest success as a trader to a large degree is his patience. He's willing and his ability to see the field and see like, is this market going to collapse? And if so, are we going to be sitting here as the team with the money and the prospects, but not as much money and prospects that we thought might have been needed in the first place? It's almost exactly what happened in the Stanton situation, where it was like it was kind of going to be the Yankees or nothing for the Marlins. And rather than get nothing and run the risk of continuing to pay the highest, you know, largest contract in history, the Marlins traded into the Yankees. There's a lot of examples of that with Brian Cashman through his 2 decades plus of being the GM. I don't think this market will completely collapse, because even if we say a walk-year position player in this age in baseball doesn't get as much as it used to. Think about J.D. Martinez last year, going from Detroit to Arizona for 3 very middling prospects. The thing that would be different between Machado and, say, Martinez is he plays a more valuable position, either shortstop or he'd have to play third base for the Yankees, as much as he might protest against it. And I think as opposed to Martinez, there are a couple of teams that see how Machado could really impact the rest of the season. Arizona again, the Dodgers, perhaps the Indians, the Phillies, the Yankees, perhaps the Braves. So all you need is a couple of teams, even bidding it up a little. I don't know that you'll get 100 cents on the dollar for someone as talented as Machado, but you'll get something more than J.D. Martinez brought.
Joel Sherman joining us. All right, Joel, let me get your thoughts on what's going on out here in the Los Angeles Angels situation. They're two games over 500. They're currently 10 games out of a wild card spot. They've had a ton of injuries this year. So where do you think the Angels are right now as the trade deadline approaches? And then how big of an impact could they play in trade talks?
Yeah, I think they're in one of the worst positions you could be in. They're over 500, which usually gives you a sense you're in it, but I think if you looked at it from 20,000 feet, you'd say they got five more games this month against Seattle. They won the game yesterday. I think if they don't run the field on it, 6-0, maybe 5-1, begin to make a real serious crack in this. How would they begin to make up that ground? Plus, by not playing great, they've let Oakland get ahead of them in the wild card standings. Amazingly, they've let the Tampa Bay Rays get ahead of them in the standings. So that's, they're not in a great place, but they have Mike Trout, and, part of every discussion is context. And one of the things you're always thinking with the Angels is, what do we have to do to make sure we keep this guy beyond 2020 when his contract runs out? And I think at some point for a team that in his first six seasons, when he was clearly the best player in the sport, only played in one playoff series, they're going to have to show the ability to win in some kind of serial way, so it's hard to become sellers. And by the way, even if they wanted to become sellers, the most obvious valuable thing they had to sell got hurt again last night in Garrett Richards. And so to me, that leaves them kind of like betwixt and between, not in a great situation. And so I kind of feel like if they can't trade Richards, they'll just do whatever they can to kind of like have an upset here and make up the ground.
We're talking to Joel Sherman. Joel, to that point, what about Mike Trout? I mean, it's another season where he may not play postseason baseball. If that's the case, how big of a loss is that from the perspective of marketing and growing the game?
Well, I mean, I would say this, Jim, and I know, you obviously do a show about all sports. What if I told you every year in the NBA, LeBron James never made the playoffs?
Sure.
Or Aaron Rodgers never made the playoffs?
Right.
At some point, that would be detrimental to the NBA, detrimental to the NFL. The things like the All-Star game and the postseason are the platform from which the sport sells broadly. There's a lot of passionate fans that follow year-round and specifically follow their team. It's the most parochial of our sports. Fans are very passionate, but like a fan in, Southern California might not care what's going on with Milwaukee, but suddenly they'll notice it come October. Hey, it's the playoffs. Let's watch in a bar. Let's watch someplace. And to not have Mike Trout on that stage has been, not only bad for the Angels, but very bad for baseball because he's our Mickey Mantle. He's a great player who we never get to see play the biggest games.
Joel Sherman joining us for a few more moments. Joel, you had a piece over the weekend that I thought was great. You might become the first person in history to compare Bryce Harper and Jeb Bush. Lay this out for me. What are the similarities you see in Jeb Bush and Bryce Harper?
Yeah, I don't know if your audience is old enough but for me to make another comparison, but I felt a little bit like Evel Knievel going up over buses trying to make that comparison.
Man, Joel, can I interrupt? I loved Evel Knievel. I am old enough. That was my guy, so I see it working. I love it.
My favorite thing would be Frank Gifford running up in the turtleneck afterwards.
Right.
So my comparison was essentially we started to think about Bryce Harper's free agency like a presidential candidacy ago, like 3-4 years. We saw it coming on the horizon. He was going to finish this season at 25, so go out into free agency for his age 26 season. He was the first pick in the draft. He's a national player in a sport that doesn't have a lot of national players. He's as talented a baseball player as there is playing the sport, maybe aside from Trout, but certainly like beyond results, just unbelievably talented. And we've been thinking about, is he going to get $300 million, $400 million, $500 million? And now in this platform year, this walk season, Jeb Bush we thought was, oh, he's going to be, you know, the Republican nominee. And we probably thought that for 3 years before the election and 2 years before the election. And then suddenly he was running for the election. And, you know, he got termed low energy by Trump and it stuck and he couldn't win primaries. And suddenly the guy we thought was going to easily walk to a nomination was out. And low energy is like low batting average. Like Bryce Harper can't get that much over like about 215, 220 this year. It's been lower than that a lot of the season. And then the question becomes, do people see beyond the numbers? I talked to his agent, Scott Boras. You know, he's still being walked at a rate where the other team fears him. He's still a power hitter, you know, with 20-plus homers. His line drive rate is the same as it's ever been. So will other teams look at that and the potential to market and – the fact that he's still only 26 and he still gets the 300, 400, 500, or have we been waiting for this candidacy that's never going to fire completely? Because the reality is, as opposed to Mike Trout, who we used to compare him to, Jim, like who's better, Trout or Harper? Trout is great every year. Harper's had one great, completely healthy season, 2015 when he won the National League MVP. There's been hints of other ones, or he's been having good years and he's gotten hurt like he did last year, but just one completely great, healthy season. And so you weigh potential and fame and great skill against that reality. And now all of a sudden he, to me, he becomes the most, what the column was about. He's the most interesting player for the second half of this season because it's his last chance to throw something up on the board to say, I am that $300, $400, $500 million player. And by the way, get the Nationals at least both into the playoffs again because they're not in first place and beyond the first round for the first time in his career for an organization, by the way, that either as the Montreal Expos or the Nationals has never even played in the World Series. So to me, there's a lot on his plate, and it makes him the most fascinating guy of the second half of the season.
No doubt. And the numbers do not lie. They're not good. He's hitting 215 for the year, 188 in June, 175 in July. So the second half is going to be fascinating. He is a baseball columnist for the New York Post. He is an MLB Network insider, Joel Sherman, my guest. Joel, so good to have you back. Thank you very much. Always good to talk baseball with you, Joel.
And it's always good to talk to you, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
You too. And I love an Evel Knievel reference. You know that. If you know anything about this show, you know I'm all about that. All right, so we look ahead to hour number three. Let me set that up for you very quickly. I'm going to start hour number three with the Smack-Off profile, which means the dudes from Team Canada get their run. Tyler in Edmonton, Matt in Van. Some of you love that. Some of you hate that. Whether you love it or hate it is immaterial to me. They're going to be a factor on the 20th. I can't say they're going to win. I can't say that either one or both hit the podium. I know they're going to be a factor. They've been a factor leading up to it. They're not taking days off. They're showing up every single day, either on the phones or on email or on Twitter. So when we come back, no days off for the Canadians. Team Canada, can a Canadian listener win the smack off for the first time ever? That topic's coming up. Also next hour, Eddie George and the portrait. Does it look exactly like him or does it look nothing like him? I want to hit on that as well. Jim Abbott, episode 43 of the Jim Rome podcast. I've got to bring that up. That's a really good app. Cheats, having another bad night last night. And your telephone calls. 1-800-636-8686. I mentioned that we front-loaded the first half of the program. All three interviews are done. Now you step up. Now we bang telephone calls. Open phones for hour number three. But at the top, when we return, Team Canada getting some run for the smack-off. We're now, what, 9 days out? 9 days out. Stay tuned. That's coming up next. You're in the jungle. I'm Jim Rome. 2 hours down. Hour number three straight ahead.